Welcome to Perpetual Notion Machine on WORT Madison this Thursday, November 5th, 2020. Tonight, I'm your host, Eric Clark, and joining me is Dr. Christina Hall, a professor in my very own department, biomolecular chemistry, as well as appointed in medical microbiology and immunology. So Christina and her lab are really broadly interested in how fungal spores germinate into an actively growing fungus, and how our understanding of this basic biology can inform how we treat patients with fungal diseases. So welcome to the show, Christina.
Thanks, Sari. Thanks so much for having me.
No problem. So how's it going? Election doesn't have you down too much, does it?
I've had to kind of put my blinders on.
Yeah.
keep my head down. Do what I need to do. Yeah, it's just one of those things that until there's an answer, there's no answer.
True.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm at. So I guess we'll just jump in and talk a little bit about who you are, where you're from, where you grew up and how you became interested in science.
Yeah. I grew up in Montana. I grew up in Helena, Montana, which is the capital, in case you forgot your geography. And it's on the eastern slopes of the Rockies, and it's a big city there, so it's about 40,000 people. And it's a terrific little community there. It has a great school system. I loved school. I grew up outdoors. And I think that that contributes a lot to the development of scientists. Kids are natural scientists. So until we make science boring for kids, they like to be curious and they like to do interesting things and they like to explore the world. And so I got to do a lot of that as a kid growing up. So I had a lot of freedom to roam about. And while the other kids were, you know, jumping off rocks and whatever, I was under the rock looking for the lichen under the rock. So I always really liked to be the kid doing that. And so I just have always done that. And by the time I was in middle school, people had said, you could be a scientist someday. And I had no idea what that really meant. But I guess I believed them. So here I am.
Yeah. That's really cool that you had kind of mentors or teachers in middle school. That seems kind of early for most folks to realize or see the light of science as a possibility.
Yeah, I think I was just really fortunate to have a family that, no matter what their level of education, because there was a big spread in my family of, you know, how much schooling anybody had, they all encouraged all the kids to just pursue whatever was really interesting and that we could do whatever we wanted to do. And so that really goes a long way with kids. So by middle school, they had us planning out all of our coursework through middle school and high school, which was an interesting thing to do to 13-year-olds, but it worked because I basically decided I was going to take all the science classes that were available to me. And it ended up, I had all sorts of opportunities through some amazing teachers to do science and learn how science works. And so I participated in a program called the Montana Science Institute, and basically doing field research with high school students. There were a couple of teachers who really got kids into that. And I think they probably ended up producing more scientists out of that group of kids than has ever been seen in the history of the state. It just, a little bit goes a long way when you really encourage young people.
So. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't know if I've spoken about it on the radio, but I have kind of a similar experience where high school experience in science really was the springboard for my own academic pursuit. So it really goes to show what huge impact really amazing teachers can have on students.
Yeah, and the teachers encouraged me to look at all of my options too. And so in high school, there was a program supported by the American Cancer Society that would award fellowships for high school students to do summer research. And it was a long time ago, before there was very much programming at that level at all. And I decided I was going to apply for this thing and see what happened. And I got it, and I got to work at the Montana State University in a laboratory that was studying basically ancient microbes, and they were studying the thermophiles in Yellowstone National Park. And so it was really cool. And so I got to do field research with those researchers. And that was a huge springboard for me. We had off-trail passes to go collect these organisms from the hot springs in the park. And I reflect on that experience a lot in terms of what I can provide, you know, kids today, and in terms of opportunities to go do really cool things. And I think field research has a way of really capturing young people.
For sure. That's so cool. I wish that there was a little bit more of that, like in kind of our day to day. You know, we're kind of siloed in the lab most days now.
Yeah.
So that's really awesome. So you learned that you wanted to be a scientist, maybe really early, but kind of started to solidify in middle school, went on to do some really cool stuff in high school. And then I presume you went to an undergrad, got the BS, and then started in grad school.
Yeah, all those things happened. I knew I wanted to do science, and the more I went through college, the more I realized how much I love it. And I had an opportunity to do summer research at Cold Spring Harbor Research Laboratories in New York, which is a famous institution for molecular bioscience research. And that opportunity was, again, another one of those springboards for wanting to, you know, knowing that I really wanted to do science after that. So graduate school made a lot of sense after my undergrad experience. And I started out thinking I wanted to be a doctor. So I went to college, and I knew that I could be a scientist, but I really had no idea what a scientist did. I didn't know what that meant. And so I declared pre-med, and I decided I was going to be, I guess I'll be a doctor. And then I got to looking at medicine, and I decided that I guess I would be a pathologist, because then I wouldn't have to actually deal with patients. And I think that is a route that sort of shows that what I really wanted to be was a scientist. Yeah. And once I figured out that someone would pay you to do that job, then I knew exactly what I wanted to do.
That's so funny that you say that, because I feel like we had just a very similar junior science career and like way of thinking, where my family, there were a bunch of nurses, and I was good at biology, so I was like, okay, gonna be a nurse or a doctor. And then I realized, like, oh, I don't really want to deal with people all the time, like outside of my home lab.
Right.
Yeah.
So I went to graduate school at UC San Francisco, and in their biophysics and biochemistry program, and got my PhD there. And then I did my postdoctoral research at Duke University. And then I went on the job market to look for faculty positions nationally. And the very best place and the very best job that was kind of my dream job came along here at the University of Wisconsin. So yeah. I feel very fortunate to have had that path.
For sure, yeah. Madison, I feel like, is a great place. I mean, I'm speaking from the perspective of a graduate student, but even for me, it's a great place to be also.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you were always really interested in like microbes and microbiology. But when did you decide to kind of zoom in on fungus or fungi? Was that in your postdoc, I believe?
So it was actually in graduate school. Okay. And it wasn't about fungi at all. My research interests were in how gene regulation occurs in complex organisms like humans. And through that exploration of trying to understand how genes are regulated, I really came to understand that there's some nice systems for studying that. And one of the systems is a fungal system. So a common fungus that people use to study that is Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which is also brewer's yeast. People learned a lot about the biology of just all organisms looking at that fungus. And so in graduate school, I started working on that fungus. And I got really interested in how evolution works across different organisms. And it led me down this path of thinking about how something like a brewer's yeast that has this very specific job and a very specific lifestyle, how an organism that's related but different, like how genes are regulated in that organism. And that's where I got into these other fungi. And it just has continued because there's 7.5 million species of fungus on the earth. It's a huge number, and it's all predicted because it's so many that we haven't discovered 90% of them at this point. That's the estimate. So there's a lot of space there to learn about how organisms live on our planet.
Who would have thought fungus is like the wild west of biology or such an open frontier?
It really is.
Yeah. And so I guess maybe to back up a little bit, I'm sure when folks listening to our show think of the word fungus or hear the word fungus, they maybe think of like mushrooms and mold. Maybe if they're connect like a little bit beyond that, they might have heard of Saccharomyces cerevisiae, as you touched on. But I guess you touch on how big the fungal world is, but maybe if you could speak a little bit more about like the range of diversity.
Yeah. What are fungi? So you're right. Mushrooms, that's what everybody thinks of. Mushrooms, molds, and then there are all these other things. Yeasts, smuts, rusts. So those are other kinds of fungi. You hear a lot of fungi that cause disease in plants. So smuts and rusts, that's where you hear about those. Some are microscopic. A lot of them are microscopic, and that they can, you know, live in all kinds of environments all over. People are most familiar, I think, with mushrooms because you can see them, and molds because you grow them in your refrigerator. At least I grow them in mine. People grow them on their bread inadvertently. And so those are the kinds of things that people are familiar with. But there's lots of fungal organisms. And the thing that a lot of people don't realize is they're not bacteria and they're not plants and they're not humans. They're their own thing. So fungi are their own classification of organisms, and they're different than all those other things. And so there's a lot to learn about. And they live in almost all ecosystems on the planet. And so they live in really close contact with all the other organisms, and they live everywhere. And so they're responsible for, you know, making sure there's enough nutrients available for other organisms to grow. So they're a really important part of life cycles all over the planet.
That's so interesting. So Why do you think that people haven't discovered as many fungi or haven't like really explored that realm of biology yet?
I think that's an open question. I don't know. Fungi are fascinating. They're different than plants and animals and humans and bacteria and viruses and parasites. They're a different thing and they're huge, but a lot of them are microscopic, so we don't see them. They grow in association with humans, but not the same way that bacteria and parasites do. So bacteria tend to grow really fast. Fungi grow much more slowly. And so I think that has a lot to do with it, that if you... some of us may have experienced seeing a mushroom pop up overnight. And so that part is really fast. But in terms of living with other organisms, they grow a lot slower. And so I think in ways they're not as noticeable. Most of the fungi on the planet that probably impact us the most live in the soil. So we don't see them. They also can look like other organisms. If with microscopically, they can look like other organisms. And so I think a lot of times people just didn't separate them out. I think it's time for humans to pay close attention to fungi for a whole bunch of reasons. And that is part of the reason that my research has gone in that direction. I think it will be important for us to understand how we're going to live on this planet with these other organisms.
Yeah, and I think we're going to touch on that a little bit later, but I do want to give you a chance to talk about your own lab's work and your favorite fungus. So I guess if you could give the audience like kind of your elevator pitch of what your lab does.
Sure. So we study fungi that cause disease in humans. And a lot of people, when I say that, will think, okay, like athlete's foot, that's a fungus. That is true. It is a fungus. Ringworm is a fungus that, you know, people might be familiar with. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the fungi that cause really severe disease in humans that cause fatal diseases. And so there are several kinds of fungi that can cause respiratory disease and blood disease and brain disease. And those are the fungi that my lab is interested in understanding, because patients who get sick with these fungi have really high mortality rates. And so the average mortality rate for someone who gets one of these severe diseases is about 50%, which is really an appallingly high number. If you think about it, think about getting a fungal disease, you've got a 50-50 shot of surviving it. And that's with the best medical care we can provide. So one of the driving factors behind our research really is understanding these fungi so that someday we will have better treatments, so that that mortality rate, we can really drop that down and give patients and doctors more options for how to treat severe disease. The fungus that we work on to understand how fungi work and grow and cause disease is called Cryptococcus neoformans. It is, for anyone who's an aficionado, it's a yeast. It's a yeast that lives out in the environment in association with tree species and soil. And we inhale it from the environment. And most of us inhale it and we're just fine. And that's true of a lot of things out in the environment. We inhale it and our healthy immune systems can clear it and it's no big deal. But for people who are immunocompromised in some way, so people who have HIV/AIDS, people undergoing chemotherapy for cancer treatment, people undergoing therapies, immunosuppressive therapies for organ transplants, those folks are very susceptible to these fungal pathogens. And that those are the people in general who are going to be most susceptible to a severe fungal disease. And so we're most interested in how individuals end up getting those fungi, and the way that most people are going to get sick from those organisms is by inhaling them from the environment. And we think that for the most part, what people are inhaling are fungal spores. And those spores are really good at dispersing into new environments. And at some frequency, they'll end up in an immunocompromised person's lungs, where they can basically establish and grow and spread to other parts of the body and cause disease. And so we're really interested in understanding that process so that we can potentially even prevent spread of fungi in people who are susceptible.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds really interesting and also like critically important, right? Like if fungal diseases are so dangerous.
Yeah, and it's one of those things, again, fungi grow pretty slowly. So it takes time for these infections to develop. And so I think when we think about bacterial infections, they can often cause fatalities very quickly. Fungi are much slower at it. And so I think it doesn't seem as worrisome. But I can tell you that my clinician friends would like very much to have better drugs to treat fungal disease, because they're much more difficult in general to treat than most bacterial infections or diseases. So there's a critical need for better therapeutics.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you're really interested in spores and the process of, I don't know if you mentioned spore germination, but the how spores enter a body and transition into a growing yeast. So I guess maybe what is a spore, and also why is spore germination the question, or like a good place to look for answers?
Yeah, so spores are basically environmentally resistant particles that fungi can make basically to help themselves spread. So we've all probably seen this with mushrooms. So if you have a mushroom and it has the gills underneath it, often if you ruffle those gills, you'll have, you know, dust kind of come out of that part of a mushroom. Those are spores. So those are the particles that the mushroom makes that it wants to have dispersed so that the mushroom can spread and survive in new environments. And fungal spores are really great at dispersal. And so much so that people have been able to follow spores around the planet so they can get on wind currents. And different populations of spores have been followed, and they really can go all the way around the Earth and into new environments. And so it's a pretty, they're pretty amazing, hardy particles that can survive. Some have been shown to survive in the vacuum of space. They're really environmentally resistant. And so that is a survival mechanism. It's a survival and spreading process. And so when those spores get into a new environment, if they have enough nutrients, for example, so if the conditions are right and there's food, they can then stop being dormant and traveling around, and they can stop and they can basically grow and make a colony. And so what you're looking at when a spore lands on your bread, when by the time you can see it, that spore has germinated and made a whole fuzzy fungal colony. And so that's the whole thing that it can do. And it's doing its job, growing in a new environment. And when the new environment is your loaf of bread, you can toss the bread loaf. When that new environment is a human lung, then you've got real problems. I really like the idea of us starting to think about fungi in terms of how they infect their hosts. And so some fungi infect plants, some infect animals, some infect people, and they do it different ways, but a lot of the diseases of humans are spore mediated. So we're inhaling them. And it seems to me that if we understood how those spores germinate, what we can do to understand that, we could learn how to stop it. And so if we have a population of people who in that population is susceptible, and we know who they are, right? So we know the people who are undergoing cancer chemotherapy and are susceptible. What if we could give them medication as soon as they start their chemotherapy that would prevent fungal spores from doing this process of germinating? Because then the fungus couldn't grow outside the lung and it couldn't cause disease in that person. And the area of prevention is an area that has not garnered much attention. And I think it's an area where we could do some good. And so we've really developed our model to look at this particular fungus that we work on with the idea that what we learn about spore germination could apply to other fungi that cause disease.
Yeah. Wow. Let me recalibrate. Why do you think prevention and targeting the spore in particular is more important than, say, targeting like the actively growing yeast in these patients?
Yes. So this is the crux. So when a patient shows up in the clinic and they have a fungal disease, by the time we're seeing them in the clinic, they have severe fungal disease. And at the point at which someone has a severe fungal disease, we have very limited treatment options. So there are basically three classes of drugs that are available. The best drug we have was developed in 1954. It kills fungi, but it is also pretty toxic to humans. And so one of the problems we have is that while fungi aren't plants and they aren't animals, they are more similar to plants and animals than they are to bacteria. And so the things that tend to kill fungi tend to also kill people. So it's a problem that if we wait too long and there's too much fungus in the human, that by the time we can kill the fungus, we have harmed the patient. So if there's a way to get at the disease much earlier, it would be better for patients. At all stages.
Right, and germination would be that early time point.
Germination would be that very early stage. One of the things that I talk about is fungi, when they get into a new environment, they're looking for food. So what they're that doesn't matter. They don't have to can have their life cycle occur in a host. They really are just looking for nutrients. And so that's how they kill patients, is basically they overgrow the patient. So if we can just stop them from growing at all in that very early stage, then we have a chance at really preventing the disease.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like a plan to me.
Well, it's not one that the field has thought about too much. And so you have to change people's ideas about how we might treat fungal disease. And so we are trying to help change people's minds about how we're doing it and that this could be another way to help us fight these infections.
Absolutely. And so we're a little bit short on time now. Maybe we'll have to do a round two to talk about fungus as the next global health threat, because I think that's a really interesting dilemma. But if you could just quickly maybe mention a little bit about like that changing the mindset and how about how even healthcare professionals and patients need to think. Change their thinking about what could be making them sick.
Yeah, so what you're making me think of is there's enough fungal disease in the world now, and we're seeing more and more of it all the time for reasons that aren't entirely clear, but may have to do with global change and global climate change. We're seeing more and more fungal disease, and so much so that the CDC is trying to promote the idea that if someone has an infection that doesn't respond to traditional treatments for bacterial infections, that their clinicians should consider that the infection might be fungal. And so they've created Fungal Diseases Awareness Week. So that was a week in September where they're trying to get clinicians in particular to think fungus. I think that's the motto, think fungus. So that if a patient isn't getting better, they may need very different treatment to save their lives.
What an interesting idea to think fungus.
There we go. I love it. I think fungus every day. I think it's the best.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think we're about out of time today. So maybe we'll have to have you on again sometime, Christina.
I think that sounds wonderful. Thanks so much for having me, Ari.
Awesome. Thanks for coming. So that's our show, everybody. I want to give a big thanks again to Dr. Christina Hall for being a fantastic scientist. I also want to shout out Christina as really a wonderful mentor and role model in our department, and to thank her for her work in making scientific communities on UW more inclusive. So you can find us, or find us, PNM, on Facebook and Twitter at Perpetual Notion Machine. And as always, thank you to Charlie, our engineer, and up next is Radio Literature.